after we do our Gita Dhyanam. We're going to start on verse 67. Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaita Amrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santutami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvashini. Let's chant verse 66. So that's the verse. That's verse 66 is really considered the final verse of the teaching itself. And it's also a kind of a summation of the whole vision. So we did that last week. I don't want to get lost in it this week. I could. It's dangerous for us to chant it. But still, it'd be nice to just capsulize that and then move on to these verses that come after the teaching. Yeah. Repeat after me, verse 66.
Sarvadharman parityajya. Sarvadharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja mamekam sharanam vraja aham tva sarva papebhyah aham tva sarva papebhyah mokshayishami ma shuchah mokshayishami ma shuchah sarvadharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam vraja aham tva sarva papebhyah mokshayishami mam shuchah.
So here Bhagavan says sarva dharman parityajya, having given up, having renounced, given up completely, that pari Tej means to renounce, to give up. Pari means all the way around, leaving nothing out. Giving up what? Sarva dharma, all dharmas, means all punya and papa, right? All the positive, all dharma and adharma. If you say all dharmas, that includes adharma. So renouncing, giving up all dharma, all of the dharmas, mam ekam, me alone, Sharanam Vraja, take your refuge in me alone. Okay. And he says, in me is Ishwara alone. Aham tva sarva papebhyah moksha ishami. I will liberate you sarva papebhyah. Tva means you. So aham, aham moksha ishami. I will liberate you, tva, you, from all papa. Ma suchaha, don't grieve. There's nothing for you to grieve. Okay. So, this human birth itself is considered 50-50 punya and papa in terms of your karma. When you take this birth on this loka, it's going to be comprised of the prarabdha karma, will be comprised of 50% punya, 50% papa. Punya means the karmas that you've previously done that when they come into manifestation will create positive situations for you that give you sukha, that give you shanti and give you peace. Where so there are other types of situations that give you dukkha. The situation, they don't have to give you dukkha, they don't have to give you sukha either. But to the degree that you are dependent upon the world and the situation to give you sukha or dukkha. Sukha, you know, is pleasure and dukkha is suffering. Mm-hmm. To the degree that you're dependent for your ananda on the world, to that degree, this 50-50 is going to be a little stressful for you. Because most people, sometimes I've said, you know, in my classes at school, I'll have people write, take a piece of paper and turn it, fold it in half, and write their beautiful life story on one side, and their horrific life story on the other. Everybody's got two sides. It's like a rope that's been woven, with a rope, you know, that's been woven with strands of sukha and dukkha. And so you can actually write out these two different stories. And it's a very useful exercise, especially when people realize that everybody can do that, that everybody has these two stories, and that's part of this, of taking a birth here. Taking a birth here is considered to be a great blessing, a great punya, because it's this birth here where you can actually assimilate, you know, your experiences and mature, you know. In the heaven world, where everything is just as you want it, there's nothing to assimilate, really, except everything's great, everything's fine. It's my moksha. It's as though a moksha bhumi, as though, even though it's temporary. But everything is going fine. There's no room for reflection. But what about when I don't always get what I want? When I do suffer, when I do experience loss. So that's kind of the purifying fire of this creation. The purifying fire in the sense of it makes me reflective. It can make me reflective. In fact, we have to be very humble, because the Shastra will say that the number of births we've had is beginningless. There's no beginning to it. And so the number of karmas that we've accrued are also beginningless. And those karmas are going to be comprised of punya and papa, right? Because it's very difficult, if not impossible, for a person who's an ajnani to continually be self-sacrificing. Because when you're an ajnani, your ananda, the self, which is really your own nature, is projected out onto the world. Right? Just like any projection in psychology, any projection that we have, right? It is a projection, but I'm seeing it out there. I'm seeing something inside of myself out there. That's what we mean by projection. In the Vedanta, you realize what is the deepest projection that we have is the projection of my own being onto the world. That's how deep it is. My very core being, who I actually am, is projected onto the world. And then, of course, I want to get it back. So there's always a struggle, in a sense, to get my wholeness back, to get myself back. And so what we call the desire template, which goes like this: I need this in order to be happy. That's what we mean by desire. The others are just preferences. I'd like this, but if I don't get it, that's fine. That's a preference. Desire, the raga dvesha, are the things that are problematic. I need this in order for me to be happy, or I need to get rid of this in order for me to be happy. And now when we say to be happy, we're not talking about something superficial. We're talking about my own well-being, my own sense of self, my own sense of completeness, my own sense of being okay with myself and with the world. In order for me to be okay on that level, I must have this. That's a desire. Right? Preferences are not a problem. For jnani, everything is reduced to a preference. I'd like this, and I don't really want that, but if I don't get it, it's fine. I'm not at stake. Desire means I am at stake. Mm-hmm. And so when that's the case, to not be making mistakes, to not be taking little shortcuts, you know, to not choosing my own ananda, or my own pleasure over what is dharma, you know, we do our best. But nobody's perfect. And so, say, in order for me to be whole and complete, I think that I'm going to exhaust all of the papa and then just live in a world of punya is not very realistic. It's not going to happen, you know. Especially if you look at from the Vedic standpoint, is that the number of karmas that you have is beginningless. And so it's almost as like saying, you know, somehow I'm going to be free of all of the things that could cause me sorrow. And I'm only going to create a life for myself that is just full of situations that will cause me pleasure. That has no, we don't have any, what we call, in logic, we don't have any drishtantas for that. We don't have any examples of anybody accomplishing that. Right? And so it just becomes sort of some sort of magical thinking. Because there's no, in any type of logical syllogism, what we call, you need a drishtanta, you need somebody, somewhere an example of it. We don't have an example of that. You know? And so in the end, your punya and papa is not going to save you, you know, because there's no end to it. It'll just keep the wheel going, you know, of the sukha-dukha wheel going. So that's why he says here, after all of this teaching, he says, give up your pursuit of dharma. Give the whole thing up, dharma adharma. Give it all up and take refuge in me alone. Now, take refuge in me alone is a big thing. It's taking refuge for my ananda, for my wholeness, for my well-being, in the self alone, the self which is Ishvara. This self that I am, this conscious being that I am, is Ishvara. There's not another Ishvara. When I take refuge for the vision of Vedanta, if I'm taking refuge in myself, the Atma, which is Brahman, I'm actually taking refuge in the self from which this whole creation has come. And so that the self that I am is the self which is Ishvara, is the self which is the being of this whole infinite creation. And so I take refuge in that self, and I let this body, mind, sense organs belong to this infinite manifestation that we call the creation. Because just in the, like in the dream, your body, mind, sense organs of the dream character belongs to the dream. It's part of the warp and woof of the dream. It's part and parcel of the dream story. So I let Ishvara have this body, mind, sense organs, which is already his. Right? So I'm just letting him have what is his. You know? And then I appreciate my life, this life, as it unfolds as part of Ishvara's dream, as part of Ishvara's creation. And my only task is to, as a jiva, from the standpoint of a jiva, is to respond to my life in a dharmic way. Because dharma, actually, the laws of Ishvara are the laws of dharma. So in the responding to this life in a dharmic way, that is my what we call Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. That is the worship of Bhagavan. And that worship of Ishvara is just my dharmic relationship to the present, to the life as it's unfolding. So my life is a response, is I'm responding to Ishvara according to the laws of dharma. And that's what I'm doing. And so he says, Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja, take refuge in me alone, because I in fact am the ananda that you're seeking. I am the ananda instead of the very being projecting out the being out onto these objects in the world. I go directly to the ananda itself. I take refuge there, and then I let this body, mind, sense organs be part and parcel of Ishvara. So then he says, doing that, I will liberate you from all papa. Because for the Atma, there is no papa. There is no punya, there is no papa, there is no karma, there is no history, there is no future. It's very interesting when you start realizing that your self, this me, the conscious being that you are, has no history. Because no time. You have no history. And you have no future either. On the other hand, your being, which is free of history and free of future, is the one in whom all of this history takes place. But you yourself have no history. That's very shocking to think about that. That you are actually free of history. Completely. And so you're not carrying any punya and papa with you. You're carrying no load. Yourself is ever fresh. Swamiji lives this. And he says in his relationship to people, to his students and to the people that are in his life, you just take everybody fresh. Yeah? Every day, every moment, just take them fresh. Because that's the truth. That's the absolute truth. You know, otherwise, you're imputing all of this history onto who is actually here right now. Right? And we do that ourselves through projection, you know. We're always projecting, the mind is always projecting its own history and its own future onto me. But I'm always free of that history. So it's a very sobering in a way to really think about it and to own that up. You know? Another thing he said around this is, you know, it's nice to be with a jnani because they're just with you as you are right now. They're not carrying any baggage. That's what he means by taking somebody fresh all of the time. They're not carrying a baggage which is a memory for them, but it's not there in you at the moment. He uses an example, like, for instance, if somebody's very upset with you, say yesterday somebody was very upset, saying all kinds of things and ranting, raving, and whatever. And then today, that's past. That's past. They don't feel that way at all. That rant is gone. But now they come and you see them again. You've been with them yesterday during the rant, you know. For them, that rant is totally gone, and now they're coming, and now they're talking to you. They don't have that rant inside anymore, but you have the memory of that rant, mm-hmm. right? And so you're relating to the person, to that rant that is no longer there, right? But who's there is the person that was there illumining that rant, but now the rant is gone. So now what are you doing? Right? You're relating to that person with that projection of yesterday. So what if you don't do that? And what if you don't do that with yourself also? Because for yourself also, these moods and whatnot, and these feelings and these worries, they're here now and then they're not here. You know, like say a depressed, when you're depressed, there's a depressed affect, you know, and that's there. You know, and then all of a sudden it lifts and it's not there, right? It's gone. So now where are you? Are you worried about the depressed affect that is gone? Or are you in the present? See what I mean? It's very transformative to get in the habit of being in the present. Because our mind worries about the past and it projects into the future. I think most people, until they gain knowledge, spend most of their life in the worried about the past, or, you know, concerned with what has happened in the past and worried about the future. That's where most of the life is lived, in this fantasy realm. And the fantasy realm produces emotion. You know? It's like if I ask you to just imagine biting into a lemon right now. You can hear, you can feel, you can taste the lemon. Your mind doesn't care whether it's an imagination or a real happening. It's generating the emotional responses. And so it's a very wonderful thing to start really thinking about this. You know, So that you gain a value for continuing to bring your mind back to the present, because that's Ishwara, and that's the true experience of your being. It's not being projected at that time. It's very clean, and it's a beautiful sadhana. So he says, do this, you know, be in the present, give up all of this dharma, all of the punya and papa, all of this kartritvam, all of this doership, you know, and just take refuge in me, in Ishwara. Ishwara, myself is, the self is Ishwara, this world is Ishwara, just come back to the present. And I'll liberate you from all of this papa. Ma suchaha, don't grieve. There is nothing to grieve, because nothing is ever happening to you, and nothing ever will happen to you. Nothing ever has happened to you. Nothing ever will happen to you, because you have no history. Your being is free from time. Nothing can touch you. All you have to do is come back to that to the reality, and break out of this imaginal world that is torturing us. So that's the verse, and that Mahasuchaha completes it, because in it's verse 11 in chapter 2 where he says, Asochanam Asochastvam to Arjuna. This is first verse. You are grieving over that which doesn't deserve any grief. And yet you're speaking to me about all of this dharma and what is right and what is wrong and all these things, but speaking the words of a wise man, and yet you're grieving over things that deserve no grief at all. Just take refuge in me. Everything will be fine. He says, take refuge in me, after he's taught about who me is in 18 chapters. You have to remember that. So now, having concluded really the teaching, let's go to verse 67. So, after having taught all of this, now he's telling Arjuna, I've taught you this entire teaching. Now you yourself could teach it. You yourself can teach it. But who would you teach it to? So he goes, Idante na tapaskaya, Idante na tapaskaya, na bhaktaya kadachana, na bhaktaya kadachana, nachashu shrushave vacham, nachashu shrushave vacham, nachamamyo bhyasuchyati, nachamamyo bhyasuchyati. It goes suyati. So it goes idam te na atapaskaya na abhaktaya kadachana nacha ashushrushave vacham nacha mam yo abhyasuyati. So who should be taught this knowledge? He says, idam te na atapaskaya na kadachana. He goes like this. Never, na kadachana, never. He says, never vacham, these words. These words should never, this vacham, this teaching, should never be taught, he goes, to atapaskaya, to someone who has no discipline, no spiritual discipline. Tapas. So atapas, the one who has no tapas, no spiritual discipline. Or never should be taught to a bhaktaya, somebody who has no bhakti. They have no shraddha, they have no devotion for Ishwara or for the Guru. Both are there. Because this teacher-student relationship, this knowledge comes through the mouth of the Guru, right? So it's a living tradition, but it has to be taught by somebody. So if the student has no shraddha or bhakti, bhakti has so many meanings. Shraddha, like shraddha, bhakti, devotion to Ishwara. There's a recognition of Bhagawan. There's a recognition of the teacher. You have some shraddha in the teacher that they can teach you. You have some shraddha in Ishwara, that Ishwara is there. You're not an atheist. And if you're an atheist, that's a whole different, this knowledge is really not ready for this knowledge. Right? If you don't have any respect for the teacher, then you're not ready to gain this knowledge from that teacher. It's useless because your mind and your heart are not available for it. So when that's, either they're not available for Bhagawan, I don't believe in Bhagawan, I don't think that's true, it's all a pile of BS, I don't believe any of that, you know. So the whole relationship with the teaching itself is already, you know, cantankerous. So he says, if there's that bhakti is there, not there, there's no spiritual discipline, then ashushrushave. This has different ways of being thinking about it. Ashushruva can mean service, where that person does not want to do any seva for the teacher or for the gurukula. But it also, so that's often translated in that way. But it also means one who's not wanting to listen, to do shravana. And if their mind is not available for shravana, shravana means that mind that's available to actually listen to this teaching. So if they have no desire to listen to the teaching, to that sampradaya, that teaching methodology, then their mind, they can have lots of bhakti for Bhagawan and they can love you, but they have and care about you and respect you and all of that as a teacher, but they don't have any interest in sitting and listening to the teaching as it's unfolded. So that's another way. Padamartha Ananda takes it in that way. But it's often taken either in that way, or it's taken in a way of seva to the teacher. Then Swamiji also will say, the seva, real seva to the teacher is coming to the class and listening to the classes. That's the real seva. That's the seva to the knowledge itself, you know. And so if that isn't there, then even if the bhakti toward Ishwara is there and bhakti toward the teacher is there, but you have no interest in the teaching, then of course that's not going to really work, right? At this time. You know, you may get some antikarana shuddhi and some punya, but in terms of gaining this knowledge, you know, it's not going to really happen. It's like a Swamiji, when he was learning the Brahma Sutras from Tadananda, who was the teacher that taught him for 4 years the Brahma Sutras, there was only like 3 or 4 people in the class, right? And so it was important. Everybody would show up for that class every day. But one of the students, and we're talking 3 or 4 students, one of the students would always fall asleep, you know, could sleep through the whole class. And then finally, Tadananda, when he started, kept happening, and Tadananda said, this class is not for sleeping. He goes, the class is not for sleeping. So Swamiji found that really funny. But it's also true. What's he getting out of the class? You know? So this class is not going to deliver the goods. If you're sleeping in it, even though you may have love and shraddha and all of that, still your mind's not ready for that teaching. So he says, it's that attitude of seva, where you have a certain devotion to the teaching itself, to gaining that teaching, like a, you know, if we say, it's like a desire. There's a desire. This is this particular formation. It's like mumukshu or jignyasu. This is sushrusha. Sushrusha, that means the one who has that desire to listen, you know. Like I've often probably realized in yourself once you're studying, I couldn't wait to get to class, you know. That's a desire to listen, to gain this knowledge. So one should have that. And he said, and then he says, mam yo abhyasu suyati. They should be, the student should be someone who is not critical of the teaching or the teacher. But to understand that, it does not at all mean to not question. Not at all. That's not the point. The point is that you can come to a teaching with a hostile attitude. You know, or you can come to the teacher with a hostile attitude. And so it's not about understanding or gaining clarity. It has nothing to do with that. You know, it's coming in with a hostile attitude, which is not going to bless you in any way. And so with that type of attitude, and no spiritual discipline, no bhakti, no desire to listen, that type of person, this knowledge is sacred, this knowledge should never be taught. Why? Because it's fruitless. It's not going to be helpful. Mm-hmm. So that's, who should it be taught? Ever, you want to turn the heater up a little bit?
Sorry?
Heater, turn the heater up just a little. I see everybody's cold in there. I'm just getting cold. Now that I've stripped off my layers.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Oh, you have it way down. No wonder I was cold.
No, I'm sorry. Now he says in this next verse, what is the fruit, the phala of this sampradaya, of this teaching tradition? So it goes in verse 68. Ya imam paramam guhyam, ya imam paramam guhyam, madbhakte shvabhidasyati, madbhakte shvabhidasyati, bhaktim mayi param kritva, bhaktim mayi param kritva, mame vaishyatya samshayaha, mame vaishyatya samshayaha. Yaha imam paramam guhyam madbhakteshu abhidasyati bhaktim mayi param kritva mam eva eshyati asamshayaha. And so now he says, talking really about the teacher, he says, yaha, the one who, imam paramam guhyam, this ultimate secret, this knowledge is considered the greatest secret because this, the atma is the knowledge is hidden in the self, right? What you're seeking is your own being. So it's considered the greatest secret because it's hidden in the seeker, right? It's the very nature of the seeker. So that's why it's called this greatest secret, imam paramam guhyam, the one who abhidasyati, the one who teaches to mad bhaktas, to my bhaktas. Mad means mine, to my devotees. Why? Because you're not going to be teaching to somebody who doesn't, Bhagavan saying, you're not going to be teaching about me to somebody who doesn't want to know about me. Somebody who doesn't care about me. In fact, for the mumukshu, Ishwara really is Bhagawan, God, Ishwara, the nature of the truth, is my highest concern, is my ultimate concern. It is my greatest love. It is what I desire in life. That's what my life is about, is to know that. Right? We say, in fact, this will come a little bit later, but in the previous verses, Bhagavan says there are four types of bhaktas. There's the artarti. Artarti is the one who, when things go really bad, things aren't working out, then you remember Bhagavan and you say a prayer. Still a bhakta, because when things are bad, then you think about Ishwara. Now, please come and save me. Then there's the arti. The arti is the one who knows I want to have this or I want to work on this, and so I say a prayer to Bhagavan before I start to gain Bhagavan's blessings for my undertakings. You know, so if things are going bad, of course I would ask Bhagavan for some help. But also when things are going fine, in order to bless my pursuits, I'll seek out Bhagavan. That's the second type. The third is the jignyasu. The jignyasu is the one who has the desire to know Bhagavan. That's the third. So that jignyasu, my bhaktas, those who want to know me, these jignyasus, right? The fourth type is the jnani, the one who is me. Right? So these are considered the four types of bhakti. So here he says, that one, the one who does know me, right? He says, that one who teaches this greatest of great secrets to my bhaktas, bhaktim mayi param kritwa, himself or herself, having the greatest bhakti, having absolute bhakti in me, the teacher having absolute bhakti in me means I'm not a samsari wanting this, that, and a little bhagavan also. You know? It's that my whole life is an embodiment of that devotion to bhagavan, where I see everything as Ishwara, and I see all of my life as just an expression of dharma. And if I'm not doing that, then that becomes my sadhana, where I'm finding myself lost in my own samsara. I always bring it back to that reality. So having that, the teacher himself having that highest devotion to me, to Ishwara, that one who teaches this most secret knowledge to my devotees, mam eva aishati asamshaya. Asamshaya. There is no doubt at all that that one will come to me. There's no doubt. The person who's... Because for the... No, there's no greater shrota, means listener, than the teacher. The one who's teaching the class gets more of the class than anybody else. Right? Because your mind is always completely absorbed in that knowledge. And if that bhakti is there, then whatever nishta, that bhakti, that devotion is there, then whatever nishta that needs to be gained, you know, so that your mind is just an embodiment of your knowledge, that your life is an embodiment of your knowledge, that will definitely come. Right? Because nobody's getting as much vision as you are. And that you're giving that vision itself is a great blessing. It's a blessing for the students, but it's also a blessing for you. Right? And so that punya and that grace will always be there. So the teacher, there's no doubt, the greatest, even in the Panchana Shi and throughout in the Sampradaya, the greatest sadhana available to you really is teaching. It doesn't matter. You know it even in samsara. If you want to learn Sanskrit, teach it. Get a little bit ahead of your students and then you teach it. You'll learn it. You know? You've noticed if you've had to teach anything, that's when you really embody it. Right? Once you start giving it out, then it becomes yours. So that's why we always say, you know, writing is also very good. If you're writing, because then you're giving it out. But giving satsang or teaching, there's no better sadhana for owning up this knowledge. So he says, definitely if that person has bhakti, it has that param bhakti, means that absolute devotion to me, that mumukshutvam is clearly there, right? And then he teaches this to those, my bhaktas, means the ones that don't have this asuya, all of these negative qualities, you know? He teaches the proper people, then that person will definitely be blessed. Yeah. So, that's the first one about the teacher. Let's go into this next one. It's also about that teacher. 69. Nechatasman manusheshu. Nechatasman manusheshu. Kaschin me priyakritamaha, kaschin me priyakritamaha, bhavitana cha me tasmat, bhavitana cha me tasmat, anyav priyataro bhuvi, anyav priyataro bhuvi. Now he says, nacha tasmat manusheshu, kaschit me priyakritamaha, bhavita nachame tasmat, anyaha priyataro bhuvi. He says, there is no one other than from this person, there among all the people, there is no one who is doing something more beloved than this person. Tasmat. Nobody is doing something more dear to me than this person. Bhavita nachame tasmat. And in the future also, no one other than this person, bhuvi, in the world, is more dear to me. So that's a twofold way to take that. When we did the four type of bhaktas, the artarti, the arta, the archi, the jinyasu, the fourth one is the jnani, there is nobody more beloved to me than that jnani. Because the jnani is myself. The jnani is the one who knows who they are. And so the jnani is not, if the person has self-knowledge, they're not a samsari. When they think of themselves, who they are, it goes right to Brahman. That's who I am. That Brahman that I am is the Satchit Ananda, is the very Ananda that everybody seeks. And it is that Brahman that is the very self of Ishwara. And so for Ishwara, what is the most dear is what is the most dear. What is the most dear is the Ananda Swarupa, right? Which is his very self. And so Ishwara, for Ishwara also, there is nothing more dear than Brahman, than the Ananda Swarupa of Brahman. The jnani is the one who says, I am that very self. So the very self that is Ishwara is the very self that is the jnani. So that's on one level. And that on that level, there is nothing more dear than the self. That's what's being said there. On another level, Krishna as an avatar of Ishwara. The job, the role of the avatar, just within the tradition, is to take a body, so Ishwara takes a form with no karma, it's just Ishwara take, there's not the karma of a jiva. Ishwara takes that karma, takes a body in order to revitalize the Vedic tradition. So to give a shot in the arm, in a sense, to the tradition, the Vedic tradition, which is failing, which is being overrun by adharma. When the balance between dharma and adharma is such that the dharmis, the ones that are holding the knowledge, are no longer able to survive. Because of the power of the adharmis, when that balance reaches a crescendo, at that time Ishwara will take a birth in order to reestablish the dharma, the Vedic dharma. I'm here reestablishing the crux of the whole Vedas are really the Upanishads, because the Upanishads deal with the nature of the reality. And the Karmakanda, the first part of the Vedas, once understanding the nature of reality itself, the nature of Ishwara itself, then all of the laws of Ishwara, all of the dharma, the adharma, all of the lokas that are going on within the creation, that's secondary to what the creation actually is, to what Ishwara actually is, in truth. So that's the Upanishads. It's the nature of the reality. Then the Karmakanda, the first part of the Vedas, has to do with what is going on within that reality. Okay. So to it would be like this. In the dream, in reference to the dream, the Upanishads would reveal the dream as a dream, and as a self, as the self of the whole dream. And the dream is mitya. Right? So that whole that's the reality of the dream. The Karmakanda of the dream would deal with all of the laws that are going on within the dream. What is dharma? What is a dharma? What is to be done, what happens to you when you die, everything that's going on within the dream. So here, we need to know. It's not. It's nice to know the rules within the dream, right? To know what will really give you the greatest amount of happiness within the dream. That would be Dharma, you know. What are those laws of Dharma that will give the greatest amount of relative happiness? What are the things to avoid, you know, that bring papa, that bring unhappiness? So how to manage it? Kind of, Swamiji will sometimes say, the Karmakanda is like a handbook, you know, for how to be in this universe to get the maximum amount of relative happiness. But that Karmakanda is not going to tell you what this world is and who I am. So it's the Upanishads that will tell me who I am and who Ishvara is and what this world is that I find myself in. So here he's saying, the Jnani is the one who is carrying on my work. My work of establishing the Dharma, right? Of passing on the Sampradaya. And so that way, that work of giving self-knowledge and giving an understanding of Dharma and of Dharma, that work is the most dear to me because that's my work. That's what Bhagavan, that's my work. But then on another level, the one who is most dear to me is my very self. And it's the Jnani who recognizes that self as my very self. And that way the most dear. Whether now or in the future, there is nothing more dear to me than that. So then, let's go and do one more and then we'll take a little break. So now, it goes to the student. Instead of just praising the teacher, the student also needs some praise here.
What number? 69?
70.
Adyeshate chaya imam Adyeshate chaya imam Dharmyam samvadam avayoho Sambhadam avayoho Jnana yegnena tenaham Jnana yegnena tenaham Ishtasyam iti te matihi
Ishtasyam
iti te matihi Adyeshate chayaha imam dharmyam Sambhadam avayoho Jnana yegnena tena aham ishtaha syam iti me matihi. So here he's talking in this verse, he's talking about the adhikari who really seriously studies this knowledge. So he says, he who adyeshyate. Hey, hi, John.
Hi. Right. Oh, good to see you.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
You know, Pooja.
Oh, yeah. I remember you. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Yeah. We're in verse 70. He says, whoever will keep the one who seriously studies, he stops just casually listening. But the one who seriously studies this samvada between us, so Krishna's talking to Arjuna. This discussion, this teaching, the samvada is when it's the teacher-student relationship. So this teaching is now going on, avayoho, between the two of us. So Krishna is saying, the one who studies this samvada, this teaching between us, this dialogue, right? Which is dharmyam, which is really Vedic. Dharmyam here means it's Vedic. It's the embodiment of the teaching of the Vedas. So Krishna is saying this teaching that I'm giving you is the Upanishads. It is the very teaching that's held in the Upanishads in the Vedas. So it's dharmyam. Does it go against dharma? But it's more than that here in this sense. It's Vedic. Right? It's true to the Vedas. So the one who seriously studies this, then he says, I am I am the one, I am worshipped. It says, Ishta Hasyam. I am worshipped by him through this Jnana Yajna. This is very important, he says. Then he says, Iti me matihi. This is my firm understanding. That's Bhagavan saying, me matihi. It's not my opinion, right? It's not a Bhagavan's opinion, it's quite an opinion. So it says, this is what I know, this is what is true. So he says, why he says this is because often a person will even, a seeker will even question, am I supposed to be doing all these various rituals or prayers or different type of yajnas and upasanas and all of these different forms of worship also? And but so Krishna says here, this itself is a jnana yajna. This knowledge itself, this sampradaya, this teaching itself is a worship. This is the worship itself. This is a yajna. So, and in fact, of the bhaktis, it's the jnani, the jignyasu and the jnani, those are the ways that I am worshipped. Right? So the jnani yajna is the way that the mumukshu and the jnani worship me through their knowledge. It's not that you have to do something else. You can do something else. You can do all kinds of rituals and these type of things because you want to, but not because in order for me to be a bhakta, I have to do these upasanas and I have to do these chants and I have to do these rituals and all that. That's nothing. This is enough. This jnanam itself gives the very punya and the very punya that you're seeking from the rituals, but it also, you know, gives you the very knowledge which is in the end what all beings are seeking. So it's through this jnana yajna that one who is studying this samvada, this teaching between the two of us, it's this jnana yajna that is through which I'm worshipped by him. So that's an important verse, because I remember that even when I was with Swamiji, you know, in the earlier courses, that was a question that would come up, you know. Do we have to do these things too? Or just, like, because my inclination, all I want to do is study and learn this. Does that count? Does that count as worship, you know? And so in this verse, yes, it counts. It counts. It's fine. It's perfect. Okay.
Iti me matihi.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my opinion, you guys. This is my clear understanding. Ishwara says. Beautiful.
Krishna's saying or
is? Krishna. But Krishna is Ishwara. See?
Yeah.
Okay, just hang on a second here. Okay, let's take a little break. We're now on verse 71. The previous verse, verse 70, was for the serious student who really listens single-pointedly and also studies the material. This is for the more casual listener, verse 70, 71. Shraddhavan anusuyascha. Shraddhavan anusuyascha. Shrinuyadapi yo naraha. Shrinuyadapi yo naraha. Sopi mukta shubhan lokan. Sopi mukta shubhan lokan. Prapnuyat punya karmanam. Prapnuyat punya karmanam. Shraddhavan anusuyascha. Shrinuyat api yo naraha yaha naraha saha api muktaha shubhan lokan prapnuyat punyakarmanam. He says yaha naraha, the person who shraddhavan is somebody who has shraddha, shraddhavan shraddha toward the Vedas, toward the teaching, and toward the teacher, means the one who gives that shuddha, the one who has that bhakti attitude and gives the benefit of the doubt.
Mm.
Right? So that person wants to understand, doesn't come in into this teaching in with a critical mindset, but with an open mindset, which is very different, right? So that one who has Shraddha, Anusuyaha, who is not critical, Shrunuyat Api, even though here Shrunuyat means just listening. It's like he comes into the teaching and he's just simply listening. He's not studying, he's not single-pointed, really wanting to get it. He's just listening to the teacher talking, right? So that's what they mean by Shrunuyat here. Even though he's just simply listening, he has Shraddha, he has that non-critical attitude. Don't take critical there in that type of we use it in academics. You have a critical mind, means you're piercing intellectual mind. That's not what's meant here. A critical attitude is where you want to defeat it before you even know anything about it. So then saha api muktaha, that person even that person is muktaha. Muktaha means liberated, but here it means liberated from papa. That person is liberated from papa. Shubhan lokan prapnuyat punyakarmanam. Having attained those auspicious worlds, the same auspicious worlds that those people who do punya karmas attain. So in the Vaidika world, the dharmis who are doing karmas in order to gain punya, those people, all within samsara, they gain exalted lokas, higher lokas, where there's more punya, there's more of a balance of punya than papa. In the higher lokas, in the lower lokas, there's more papa. This loka, it's 50-50. So the people who are dharmanishtas, who are committed to dharma, who are doing karmas in order to gain punya so that they can get a higher loka, doing upasanas and meditations and rituals and all of these things, like those people, this person also, who's just exposing themselves to the Gita, just casually listening, that person gains the same merit, the same punya, the same positive lokas, the same freedom from papa that these other people gain. So this is just a real praise, which is typical in the whole Vedic tradition of the text. There'll be a lot of praise. Just by chanting these verses, these particular verses in the Rudram, there's just one shloka. If you chant that one shloka, it's as good as chanting the whole Rudram. It's as auspicious. And so here, there's so many rituals that can be done, so many things a person has to do to gain these higher lokas. Whereas if you just simply come to class and you're just simply listening, you know, with Shraddha, you know, that alone will free you of all of these papas. That's the praise of the Gita. And the praise of the one who comes into the vicinity of this teaching. That's very much part of the tradition. It comes up, like Swamiji's talked about it also. It's in the whole, you know, it's kind of like in the whole world, there's only a small number of mumukshus and a smaller number of teachers, you know? And so to have it in your karma to come even near somebody who, come near this sampradaya, this teaching tradition, is considered a great, great punya. Because why, what is it that would bring you into the vicinity of this knowledge, which is moksha, which gives moksha? So it's considered to be a great punya to even meet a teacher, or to even be listening to this knowledge, even if you're not that interested. You've still come into the vicinity of it. So it's considered like the knowledge itself is a great blessing. It's falling somehow maybe not central to your karma, but it's peripheral to it. And that itself is considered a punya. When you think about your karma, one little association that comes to my mind, I'm sure most of us have had this experience, like say you've gone over to London or to Europe or somewhere, you're traveling, and out of the blue you meet somebody that you know on the other side of the world for no reason, there's no reason at all, you know, but there they are, mm-hmm. you know. And so these beings are in your karma, and it doesn't really matter where in the world they are, you'll still run into them, mm-hmm. you know. And so here, when you meet a teacher, you meet a Mahatma, or come to a place where the Sampradaya is taking place, that is in your karma. And that's considered a very great punya, you know, to even come into the vicinity of this knowledge. So that's how it's praised. So let's do the next one. Kuchit deited shrutam parata. It's not kuchit, sorry. It's kachit. Kachit etat shrutam parata. Kachit etat shrutam parata. Tvayai ka grena chetasa. Tvayai ka grena chetasa. Kachit ajnanasam mohaha. Kachit ajnanasam mohaha. Pranashtaste dhananjaya. Pranashtaste dhananjaya. Kanchit, kachit, etat shrutam parta, tvaya ekagrena chetasa. Kachit ajnanasam mohaha, pranashtaha te dhananjaya. So now here, after praising the teacher, and praising the two types of students, he asks Arjuna a question. And the question is, Hey Partha, Arjuna, Hey Partha, is the kachit, just means is, it's addressing, asking a question. Is this which has been heard? Shrutam means everything that I've taught. This that I've taught to you, etat shrutam, has it been heard, tvaya eka grena chetasa? Has it been listened to you with a mind that is single-pointed? Eka means one, agra means tip, and single-pointed. So have you been listening to everything I've said with a mind that is single-pointed on what I've been saying? Then he says, kachit, again asking a question, ajnanasam moha pranashtaha te dhananjaya, hey dhananjaya, you know, the one who is victorious over all wealth, he says, has the delusion, the moha, your ajnanam, your ignorance, and the moha, sammoha, and the delusion that's caused by that ignorance, has that been destroyed for you? Has that ignorance, pranashta, been pranashta means destroyed. Pranashta means, has it been completely destroyed? You know, have you listened clearly with single-pointedly? And has your ajnanam and the delusion caused by that, has that been completely removed? So the question is, why is Krishna asking this? First of all, as his teacher, he should know. But
yeah, no, it's okay.
But then Shankara says this. Traditionally, in tradition, if, for instance, Arjuna were to say no, then as his teacher, he has to figure out another way to teach him. Like, what is the obstruction that's causing his student, Arjuna, not to get this? What does he need? And so if Arjuna, we'll see how he answers, but if Arjuna is to answer, no, I'm sorry, I don't get it, it's not clear. The 18th verse, okay, we need chapter 19. We have to continue on. But also he has to figure out what it is, because he has Shraddha, and he wants to know. Because Arjuna asked Krishna to please teach him, to please accept him as his student, and to please teach him. And Krishna said, okay. So he agreed to that relationship. And Arjuna is stuck with him all this way, you know, and has been following and asked his questions. So now, from Krishna's mind, he's taught him everything. But is that so for Arjuna also? Right? And so Arjuna has to tell him, yes, everything is fine, I'm clear. Or no. And if he says no, then we have to continue on. He has to figure out what else is needed for Arjuna to really understand this. Does he have to do some different types of sadhanas or what to get the antikarma shuddhi? Or is there some area that's been left out where there's still some vagueness? What is it? Right? And so that's why to strengthen the understanding of the sampradaya, the teaching tradition, this verse is inserted, is there. Pardon me, Shankara. Okay? So, let's see how Arjuna answers in 73. He says, Nashto moha smritir labdha, Nashto moha smritir labdha, Twat prasadat mayachita, Twat prasadan mayachita, Statosmi gatasandehaha, Statosmi gatasandehaha, Karishe vachanantava, Karishe vachanantava. Nashtaha mohaha smritihi labdha, Twat prasadan mayachita, Stittaha asmi gatasandehaha, Karishe vachanantava. He says, Nashtaha moha, my confusion, my delusion is nashtaha. It is gone. It's been destroyed. Nashtaha moha. Smritihi labdha. That recognition, that clarity, that knowledge, labdha, is gained. That smriti, that recognition, that knowledge, labdha, is gained. Twat prasadat, by your grace, because of your grace, maya, by me, he achyuta. Achyuta is a name for Krishna. It means the one who never decays or changes in any way. So he achyuta, this knowledge that the moha is destroyed by me, the knowledge is gained by me, twat prasadat, by your grace. By your grace means what? The grace of the teaching itself. Because the teaching has to be very, very thorough. It's not just saying, you are Brahman, go in peace. There's a lot of teaching involved, you know. And Krishna has thoroughly, in 18 chapters, thoroughly gone through every aspect of what the Upanishads have to say. That's why this Gita is considered so sacred. You know, it's considered a very, very sacred text because it takes care of everything. Not just the knowledge from every aspect, but also all of the sadhanas, the antikarana shuddhi, the karma yoga, everything is included in it. So it's very revered. So he says, twat prasadat, because of your grace, through that thoroughness of teaching, this has been taken care of, all this. Moha has been removed, the knowledge is there. He says, stittaha asmi gatasandeha. I stand here as one for whom all of the doubts, the sandehas, all of the doubts are gone. Karishe vachanantava, I will do now what you want. What you've recommended, what you've told me to do, I will do. Because all through the Gita, Arjuna was saying, shouldn't I just go to the forest and take sannyasa? And just study. That's what I want to do. I don't want to fight this war. I don't want to be here. I want to go. And that, won't that be the quickest way for me to gain moksha? And all the way through, there's several times when this little question would keep coming back. Krishna would always say, no. No. You need to stay in the field. You need to stay in the field of your experience in order to, you know, to be able to give up these ragas and dveshas and actually change your nature, you know, change your disposition, you know. You can't take the disposition you have, which is the disposition of a warrior, of a kshatriya, and then just plop it over into a forest, sitting there all by yourself trying to meditate. You have to stay in your world, and within your world neutralize your raga dvesha. Otherwise you just take them there and they're just sitting inside of you. That's not going to work. It's not the fastest way to go. So he's told him this in so many different ways. And now at this point, Arjuna gets it. Because you do have to be a jnani in your world. You don't want to go outside of your world in some secluded little place, you know, and think that you'll be able to get knowledge and have the antikara and the shuddhi. You know, for one thing, you'll become restless there. But the other thing is, once you come back to your place, all of the samskaras and all of the problems and all the raga dvesha that has been lying dormant in there will just rise up again. Mm-hmm. You know? And so that's not the way to go. And so now at this point, Arjuna understands. And he knows himself and he understands. It's not a problem. So he says, Karishye, I will do vachanam teva, what you've advised. I'll do what you've advised. And now at this point, the Gita, the dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna is over. Krishna asked him, are you clear? Is everything fine? And Arjuna has said, yes, everything is perfect. I'll do what you've suggested. Over. There's nothing more to be said. And so now what happens is Sanjaya, who has been, if you remember at the very beginning, remember 8 years ago, at the very beginning of the Gita, Vyasa, who is writing this down, gave Sanjaya what we call a divya chakshu, a divine eyes, to be able to see and hear from a distance the whole dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna, and also know everything that was going on in everybody's mind. And seeing that, he then related everything he was hearing to Dhritarashtra, who was the blind king, who is the father of Duryodhana and the 100 brothers. There are 100 brothers that were all the sons of Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra was blind. So Dhritarashtra wanted to know what was going on between the Pandavas with Arjuna and the Dhritarashtras. And so Vyasa gave him this divine vision that allowed him to see everything and then relate it to the blind king, Dhritarashtra. Okay? So now, this dialogue is over. So now Sanjaya has to wind it up with, and he's talking now to Dhritarashtra, since this is over. Sorry, Chibi, go ahead. Okay, you try. So let's do it. Sanjaya says now that this whole dialogue is completed, Sanjaya now is saying a few words to Dhritarashtra, the blind king. He says, Sanjaya uvacha, ityaham vasudevasya, parthasya, Chamahatmanaha, Sambadam imam ashrausham, Adbhutam ramaharshanam. He says, iti, thus, aham I, Vasudevasya Parthasya cha Mahatmanaha Sambharam, imam ashrausham, aham ashrausham, I have heard this samvada, this discussion, this teaching between Vasudeva, the Lord, Krishna, and Partha, who is Mahatmanaha, both who are of great minds, huge, great-minded ones. Vasudeva means the one in whom all exists, who is Deva, consciousness. The conscious being in whom the whole creation exists is Vasudeva. And then Partha is the name of Arjuna after his mother, Prithi, I think, Prithu or something like that. So Partha, Prithu or something. It's a name for his mother. So it's a name for Arjuna. Then he says, I've heard this whole discussion between Vasudeva and Partha, Arjuna. And it's adbhutam, this discussion, this teaching. Samvada means the dialogue between the teacher and student. I've heard all of this, and it's adbhutam. It's what this wondrous, wonderful, narrative, miraculous adbhutam wonder, this wonder of a discussion that is Romaharshanam, that makes my hairs stand on end. You know, that horripilation. So, I've heard this. And then he goes, next verse, Vyasa prasadat shrutavan, Vyasa prasadat shrutavan, imam guhyatamam param, imam guhyatamam param, yogam yogeshwarat krishnat, yogam yogeshwarat krishnat, sakshat katayatas swayam, sakshat katayatas swayam, Vyasa prasadat shrutavan imam guhitamam param, yogam yogeshwara krishnat sakshat katyataha swayam. He says, so he goes on, Sanjay goes on to say, because of the grace of Vyasa, because Vyasa is the one who gave him the Divya Chakshu, this special vision, because of Vyasa's grace, Shrutavan, I heard imam guhitamam param, this most secret, right? Param yogam, this most secret yoga. Yoga is this whole teaching itself. The yoga is the jnana yoga and the karma yoga. The jnana yoga is the shravana, manana, nididhyasana, and then the karma yoga is all of the sadhanas for antakarana shuddhi, for purity of mind. So this most exalted yoga, he said, Yogeshwarat Krishnat Sakshat Katyataha Swayam. I have heard this from Krishna, who is the Lord of yoga, the Lord of this yoga, Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga. Yogeshwarat Krishnat. I have heard it Sakshat directly, immediately, Katyataha Swayam, as he himself was talking. You see, since Sanjaya had this Divya Chakshu, he was actually hearing Krishna give this, Harry the Lord, give this teaching. Mm-hmm. It's not as though Krishna said this to somebody and then somebody told somebody else and somebody told somebody else and now finally he gets it. Third, fourth, fifth hand. No. He was able, because of Vyasa's grace, to hear this teaching immediately directly right from Krishna himself, right from Krishna's mouth, as he was teaching Arjuna. But then he says, Rajan samsmritya samsmritya, Rajan samsmritya samsmritya, sambadam imam adbhutam, sambadam imam adbhutam, keshavarjanayo punyam, keshavarjanayo punyam, rishyami cha muhur muhuhu, rishyami cha muhur muhuhu. He says, O king, talking to Dhritarashtra, Dhritarashtra, samsmritya, samsmritya. We're having heard, having remembered, recalling. When he says it twice, it just says, I keep recalling over and over again this wondrous discussion, samvada imam adbhutam. Adbhuta means wondrous. Over and over in my mind, I'm just letting this fall, repeating this in my mind over and over, this wondrous discussion, Keshava, Arjuna Yoho, between Keshava, Krishna, and Arjuna, this wondrous discussion, which is punya, which is so, which is the embodiment of punya itself. You know, it's, which is such a huge blessing. It's like I've been given this great punya, this wonderful discussion that is the punya itself. I've been just letting it run through my mind over and over again. Vrishamicha muhur muhuhu. And I am ecstatic. Again and again I find myself ecstatic, full of joy, thinking about this over and over again.
Who's saying that?
Sanjaya. He's saying it to the king, the Dhritarashtra. Oh, king, you know. I keep running this through my mind over and over again. This wondrous discussion between Krishna and Arjuna, which is so full of punya. And I find myself again and again ecstatic with happiness. Mm. Then he says, Tat-cha-sam-smitya Rupam atyadbhutam harehe Rupam atyadbhutam harehe Vismayo me mahan rajan Vismayo me mahan rajan Vrishyami cha punah punah Vrishyami cha punah punah Tatcha samsmritya samsmritya Rupam atyadbhutam harehe Vismayaha me mahan rajan Vrishyami cha punah punah. He says, and I keep having remembering over and over, bringing my mind over and over, tat rupam adbhutam harehe. That wonder, more than wondrous, absolutely wondrous form of Hari, of Krishna. Because in verse, in chapter 11, Krishna let Arjuna see the whole, his whole form. You know, the whole form, the form of the whole creation. So he's, so now Sanjaya saw it too. So I said, and I can't get that out of my mind. I see that wondrous form of Hari over and over again. And he says, what a great wonder. You know, for me, this great wonder, Vismayaha me mahan, O king. He says, O king, this, talking to Dhritarashtra, this was such a great wonder for me. I hrishyami cha punah punah. Again and again, I find myself in ecstasy, ecstatic. Okay. And then he says, again, remember, he's talking to the Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra, the, his sons were the evildoers. They were the poppies, right? And so Sanjaya has to be tactful because he's so overwhelmed by Arjuna and Krishna, and he himself is a Dharmanishta, and poor Dhritarashtra is in so much agony over what has happened, and also even the behavior of his sons are an embarrassment. So here he says, ending the Gita with this, Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna Yatra Partho Dhanurdharaha Yatra Partho Dhanurdharaha Tatra Sri Vijayo Bhutihi Tatra Sri Vijayo Bhutihi Dhruvani Tir Matir Mama Dhruvani Tir Matir Mama Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna
yatra parutaha dhanurdharaha tatra shrihi vijayaha bhutihi dhruva nitihi matihi mama. He says, yatra, wherever the Lord is, Yogeshwara Krishna, wherever Krishna is, who is the very Lord of this knowledge, and wherever Parta is, who is Dhanurdharaha, the one who wields the bow, for Arjuna, the wielder of the bow is the one who is fighting for Dharma, to maintain the Dharma, the one who lives for Dharma. So wherever Krishna is, and wherever Arjuna is, so wherever the Dharmi is, who carries Krishna in his heart, right? There will always be Shri. There will always be wealth. And Shri here can be the wealth of Vidya, can be Shri in general, but we have another word for wealth and prosperity. So there is Shri, there is wealth, the wealth of knowledge. There is Vijaya, victory. There is Bhutihi, prosperity. Dhruva Nitihi, there is always the strength of justice. Dhruva means it doesn't go away. The Shri doesn't go away, the Vijaya doesn't go away, the Bhuti doesn't go away. It's Dhruva, it's firm. And the Nitihi, the justice. Then he says, Matir, he says, this is Sanjaya saying, Matir Mataha, that's my idea. This is, it's not Krishna talking. Sanjaya is humbly saying this to Dhritarashtra, you know, wherever Krishna is, wherever Arjuna is, you know, is the one who carries the bow of Dharma, you know, and Krishna is the Lord of knowledge. They're all Shri and victory and prosperity, and all justice is there. This is what I think, he says to Dhritarashtra. So, Om Tat Sat. So repeat after me. Om Tat Sat. Om Tat Sat. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Upanishad Su. Upanishad Su. Brahma Vidyayam. Brahma Vidyayam. Yoga Shastre. Yoga Shastre. Shri Krishna Arjuna Sambhade. Shri Krishna Arjuna Sambhade. Moksha Sanyasa Yoga Nama. Moksha Sanyasa Yoga Nama. Ashtadasho Dhyayaha. Ashtadasho Dhyayaha. Om Tat Sat. Om. This is the truth. Iti thus. Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su Upanishadsu. In this Bhagavad Gita, which is considered to be an Upanishad, Brahma Vidyayam, which is the teaching of Brahman, which there is the teaching of Brahma Vidya, the knowledge of Brahman, and it is also a Yoga Shastra. In this Yoga Shastra, Karma Yoga, so it gives Brahma Vidya and it gives Karma Yoga. Sri Krishna Arjuna Samvade. In this Samvada, this teacher-student relation dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, Moksha Sanyasa Yoga Nama, this yoga, that here, yoga means chapter, this chapter called Moksha Sanyasa, that has to do with moksha, liberation, and sannyasa, complete renunciation, Nama Ashtadhyayaha, this 18th chapter called the Moksha Sanyasa Yoga. This is the 18th chapter called the Moksha Sanyasa Yoga. In this dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, in the Brahma Vidya Yoga Shastra, in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, which is an Upanishad, this is now complete. Om Tat Sat.
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 So. But there's a third option.
Yeah. Moksha. There's a third option.
Third one.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? There's something I've just always wondered about. I've never quite understood why. So Bhagavad Gita is considered an Upanishad, but I mean,
why it is?
Well, not why exactly, but just all the other Upanishads seem like they don't really have much like context, and this one has like so much.
It's praised as the equivalent to an Upanishad. It's viewed as an Upanishad. First of all, the Lord is teaching it, right? But as important as Bhagavan is teaching it himself, but the content of it is the same in terms of the knowledge. And so he's giving Krishna is giving the knowledge that is contained in the Upanishads. And so out of praise and respect, it's viewed as an Upanishad, but it's actually Smriti. Shruti means that has come along with the creation. You know, doesn't have an author. The author is the unembodied Lord, Ishwara. The Smriti is what, like once that knowledge is there, then somebody might write a text like Atma Buddha or Panchadashi, that in order for that to be Smriti and to be studied as part of the Vedanta, it has to have the same vision as the Upanishad, but it's called Smriti. So here, this is being taught by Krishna, who's embodied. It's taking place between two people, so it's technically a Smriti. But because it's the Lord, it's praised as an Upanishad. See what I mean?
It also kind of seems more like it's, because it's part of this story that's not like, that it's kind of for more people.
It is meant to be for more people. It's meant to be for everybody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And especially with all that's given in terms of karma yoga and attitude. Other Upanishads do have a story, like for instance, the next one we're going to do, the Katha Upanishad. The whole first chapter is the story of Nachiketas going to Lord Yama. And in that story you learn all the qualities of a mumukshu, what makes a mumukshu, and all of the attitudes and all of that. So there can be stories in a new Upanishad, but it still has the stature of a new Upanishad, where this is praised as a new Upanishad.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's the difference. Yeah.
The question, when you were speaking about that the realized Atma has no history, no future, and then yet, I couldn't get, did you say yet it contains the history?
Oh.
If you could just speak more about that.
What I meant there is that from the standpoint of the creation, mm-hmm. there's time and space and history. There's cause-effect, there's mm-hmm. past and there's future, right? But that whole creation that includes time and space is what we call mitya. Means it rests, it has for its being the non-dual, timeless Brahman. That is its truth. But from the standpoint of Brahman, there is no time, there is no space.
Mm-hmm.
So time and space itself exist in that which is free of time and space. See what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for you as a jiva, there is no such thing as a jiva, in the sense that from another standpoint, your being is totally free of time and space. But this body enjoys that being completely. The body has time and space and history and cause and effect. But it exists in and has for its being that which is free of time and space and cause and effect, which is yourself. So we are always viewing and relating to ourself from the standpoint of the upadhi. So I think of myself always as having history, because the upadhi, the body and the mind and everything that exists within duality does have history. So I think of myself as having history. But really the only thing that has history is the upadhis, not me. I'm absolutely free of history. And of cause and effect, and of change. So that's something very, very liberating about that. And a little disconcerting also.
Well, it's like almost to see how they meet. You know, that's that place of...
Yeah, how do they...
Resting.
Yeah. So you can you recognize in your own totality of your own experience, which has to do with objectifiable experience, like that an objectifiable experience has history, it has cause and effect, you know, it has time and space. Objectifiable means it's something that I illuminate, I watch it change, etc. That's it's objectified. But that objectified experience takes place in me, who is not objectified, the conscious being that I am. And that's not changing. That's why I'm ever present to whatever experience is there. The experiences are not ever present. The experiences come and go. I'm the only thing that doesn't come and go. And I'm the self which all experiences enjoy. So I'm the stable one. But the experiences coming and going, they have cause and effect from their own standpoint, but I'm not affected by their cause and effect. So for me, I'm always the same. There's no history at all for me. As I am, that's it. And nobody can do anything about it, including me.
And you can't give it history.
You can't give it history. You can't do anything about it. Because it's free of you're free of time.
And you're not you.
Yeah.
And you're not you.
What do you mean?
Well, you just shift your locus of sense of self from a deluded self of conditioned subject to history self.
Yeah.
And ignorance is dispelled, and one becomes aware of their self as self.
Yeah.
Jiva to Atma. As that shift happens, and then, let's say, witnessing happens, or a relationship to that self happens, because you're now seen as self, an objectified not self.
Yeah, yeah, what you had objectified, you know, has for its truth yourself, but from your own standpoint, there's no change.
So there's a relationship still.
Only from the standpoint of the changing jiva, changing body, changing bodies. But it's not a real relationship. It's like the relationship between a pot and the clay.
Right, it's almost not.
It's a mithya relationship, because really there's only clay there. And so this body has a sense of self, but that's like the pot has a sense of being clay, because the only thing that's really there is clay. So the only thing is this self, this body, enjoys me completely, which is true. But if the body goes, nothing happens to that me. So
it's still from that, there.
That's the satya mitya relationship. Play pot.
So to say that I have no history is more of a teaching methodology to show you that the self doesn't have history, doesn't have time.
Yeah. But I can say that you're free of time, you're free of space. But somehow to say you're free of history is just it's the same, but it gives another little twist because you're using a different word.
Yeah, yeah.
So it makes you see it a little bit differently. Your body and your mind and sense organs all have history. Because they're within time. No. But you're not.
No, Kurukshetra was a real place. It's a real place, right?
They think so. They think they know where that Kurukshetra is.
I mean, there's a town. When I was going to India, I suddenly looked out the window and there was Kurukshetra.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a town north of Delhi.
I think that's
right,
yeah.
Hours,
yeah.
And it actually exists there.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, now, with some of these stories, I guess it's not quite clear if they happened or they partially happened, and then there was a story, you know, it was kind of developed further into a story, or, I mean, nobody knows that?
No.
How is that, really?
Well, I think that's kind of the nature of myth.
Yeah.
If you don't know what the kernel was, upon which this myth has developed.
Mm. And we also don't know the timing on this, right?
Not really. The timing is all in Jyotish time, where the stars were all located.
Yeah.
So it takes a paragraph to tell the time. all the planets and were located and this and that, you know. And so astrologers argue about when exactly that was.
I see.
In our linear time.
Right, right.
But they'll have these, if you're reading in the Sanskrit, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, they'll have time in Jyotish time.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, do we know what happened after this? There's no continuation of the story, right?
This is located in the middle of the Mahabharata. The Gita is. The Mahabharata is 18 volumes. It's long.
It continues. Yeah.
All we're looking at is the dialogue right before this war happened, but it happens right in the middle of the Mahabharata. So there's like 9 volumes before, telling all kinds of history and stories, and then the whole story of Arjuna and the Pandavas and how they grew up, and you know, it's very detailed. And then how they got into the situation of having had the war. And then there's the long volumes of the war, where everybody ended up being, just about everybody was killed. It's just a bloody mess.
So did Vyasa write this, or did he just compile it?
I don't know.
Okay. Because sometimes I get the sensation that, the sense that he wrote the Gita, and that's why it's a Smriti.
I don't know.
Okay.
I have a question about Mithya. It seems, you know, it's clearly not the same as Satyam, and doesn't have that, it's not the same order of reality. But it sure seems real.
I know, but order of reality is the right word. It's not the same order of reality.
It's not that it's unreal, it's just not as real.
Exactly, well yeah, it's not that it's unreal. If you say unreal, unreal in reference to what? Because within itself, it holds together very tightly. I mean, we have science, we have everything. We have shared reality, it's called Vyavahara. But it just doesn't have ultimate.
Myself, it hurts and
it
pains.
But of course, like Gaudapada would say, if you cut yourself in the dream, it hurts and it bleeds.
Mm.
It has reality from within its own standpoint, from within its own world. But it doesn't have ultimate, absolute reality, because everything within it comes into being and goes out of being. That's what makes it a different order of reality. But you can't just dismiss this as though it's not here. And then the dream, or the subjective reality, exists within the objective reality, and it has less reality if you're comparing subjective to objective. But from within itself, it is real within itself. Like the dream is real for the dream characters within the dream. But upon analysis, its reality won't hold up.
And the thing is, we can have an experience of waking up from a dream, but there's a way in which, unless we die, we don't wake up from this reality and our bodies are gone. Like, you know, you wake up from a dream, your dream body disappears. The whole dream world disappears. This one never does unless you die. I mean, and I've never had that experience that I can remember. You know, I don't remember dying and coming back. And
yeah, but even then, with death and coming back, you're still within time and space. It would be like a dream character is within the dream, dies in the dream, and goes into another dream loka, and then is reborn.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still within the dream world,
mm-hmm.
the dream reality. So here, in this reality, dying, you're still dying within as a jiva, transmigrating jiva, within this duality, objective duality.
You're just repeating the dream, basically.
Yeah, except it's it's the waking state instead of the dream state. So it's Ishvara Srishti instead of Jiva Srishti. Ishvara Srishti is the objective world in which this physical body exists, dies, take other physical bodies like that.
So that's where there's some kind of faith that has to come in. That there's the dream world is to this reality as this reality is to Satyam.
Well, it's not quite like that. It's that the from the standpoint of Satyam, from the standpoint of Brahman, okay,
mm-hmm.
the dream world and the waking state are equal. In terms, both are mitya.
Okay.
But from the relationship of the dream to the waking, the dream is subjective, the waking is objective. The dream is Jiva Srishti, the waking is Ishvara Srishti. But from the standpoint of awareness, both of them are mitya.
But from the standpoint of this reality, the dream does seem like mitya in a way that this reality doesn't.
That's why
the analogy works.
Yeah, that's true. But we have to establish the mityatva of this reality just based upon the logic
mm-hmm.
of name and form. And
that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So that it takes a certain faith. That's why, because it's based on logic. It may be based on logic, but it's not something that we experience in the same way that waking up from a dream.
It's not in the same way, though. The logic is a logic that's very much tied to your experience, which negates the reality of the experience. It negates the satyam order of reality of your experience. Yeah. If you take these words, satyam and mitya, as words that are not denoting a thing, but they're denoting an order of reality. Mm-hmm. So we would say, satyam means that which can never be negated in past, present, or future. That's the definition of satyam. Mitya is that which cannot be categorized as satyam or as non-existent. Number one definition. Number two is that which is totally dependent upon an adhishtana, upon something else for its being. It has no independent being. That's its order of reality. So dream and waking will fall under that order of reality. Because upon analysis, this is the whole Gaudapada, what he's doing over and over in so many different ways is to negate logically upon analysis any type of satyam for this waking or dream. And he uses the dream to help you understand as a drishtanta that this waking state is not really different.
Which Upanishad is that?
Mandukya.
Mandukya. Mm.
Is it only logic that can get us there in the tradition of Vedanta?
No. The logic, Vedanta will say logic actually can't get you there. But the Upanishads get you, the Shruti itself, the Upanishads, get you there, make you see it, and then any amount of logic will support it.
But given that I am Brahman, and that is my true nature of
mm-hmm.
who I am, then in theory I should be able to experience that.
Well, you are experiencing it right now, that's the problem.
And from the standpoint of that experience, the witnessing of my conditioned reality, though not a relationship, begins the duality.
Well, the thing is, you can, on your own, you can get to this drisha to a certain degree where you're recognizing that subject-object relationship.
From the standpoint still of the object, but nonetheless, in a sense, also from the standpoint
of the subject, but in the end, the whole knowership of the subject has to go.
Even up to that, it's still not it.
No, not as long as there's knowership there, then you're still tied within that duality. And so that has to be dismissed also.
Does it say anything about levels of meditation that transcend knowership qua knowership?
Yeah, but the problem is with a meditative experience, as profound or that as that may be, when you come back from it, the ignorance hasn't been removed. And so what happens is you remain as a jiva who has had a meditative experience that was profound. But the ahankara, the I notion, doesn't necessarily at all shift from you, the jiva, the body-mind sense organs, who has had this beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. Whereas what has to happen is that the ahankara has to be go, and this becomes the I, you know. But the I is not a knower. And so from the standpoint of the mind, there's only knower known. And that knowership has to be given up.
So is enlightenment possible?
Yeah, exactly. It's possible because that's who you are. It's just you need a teaching methodology to hold up a mirror. Otherwise, the ignorance in the mind won't be removed. The mind will have experience, but it won't remove the ignorance.
But those experiences can be, like Michael was saying, you can have an experience similar to waking up from a dream from this reality also. You can have an experience of that.
Yeah, you can have like a nirvi kalpa samadhi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can actually have that experience, and it's helpful.
It's helpful, but when you wake up from that experience, when you come back, you are still you, the mind, who has had this wonderful non-dual experience, and you know it's the truth, but you don't know what that means.
Yeah.
You know?
But can I?
You can, because you are that.
But can I know what it means?
Yeah, you can know what it means completely. But you have to know, what it means to have a context for that experience.
Does it say anything, does the teaching say anything about how we hold ourselves with the best knowledge that we have as not that which we unavoidably are? In other words, we're stuck in this.
Yeah, the best way that the Upanishads or the Vedas will talk about it is to be a dharmanishta. You follow dharma. And dharma is something that reveals itself. It's not like you really have to be taught dharma. The golden rule, you know the first half of dharma. In this sense, do unto others as I would have done to myself. You know that everybody should treat you in that way. Do unto others as I would have done to myself. Yes, you should all treat me like that. I know that's how we should, you know. I just don't know that I should treat everybody like that because my own raga dveshas get in the way. But that dharma is something that is known to me. And then I become, if to the degree that I'm dharmic, to that degree my mind has shanti. And that shanti gives a mind that reflects myself. It doesn't give me knowledge, but it gives me the comfort of my mind being like a clear water bucket, you know, reflecting the sun. So the mind is like, in a way, kind of a mirror image to me. See what I mean? But I need to go further than that, because then I have to maintain that mirror image so that I can feel comfortable, you know. In the end, I have to recognize my own being that's never changing. Not dependent on the mirror image, which I can get the most close to is through dharma.
But I think, you know, it seems like one of the greatest challenges is because recognizing who I am means I live in a non-dual reality. So it's kind of realizing this a state of non-dual awareness within a dual reality.
Yeah, but we have to remember that the non-dual awareness is self-evident. It doesn't need the world. It's self-shining.
Right.
But the mind is the one who's taken that me to belong to itself. And so then it becomes a knower and all of this kind of stuff. And there's all... You just become a jiva.
Yeah.
And you're an unlimited individual within this creation. It's not that the whole creation is within you and that has no being apart from you.
I remember what really stayed with me when you shared, I think it was an invitation to free our awareness from, you know, the conditioned self, so we can actually, so our awareness can just rest in the Atma.
Well, our awareness actually is the Atma.
Okay.
But I know kind of what you're saying, your mind can differentiate.
It is the mind, the awareness.
And recognize the truth of itself, which is changeless. I think that's what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we take just a little break and then meditate, do our chanting into the new year.
Yes. What are we going to chant?
We're going to, do you have the handout? We're going to chant the first one, which is the Mula Mantra, Dakshinamurti Mula Mantra. We'll do one mala of that. And then we'll do another mala of the Dakshinamurti mantra. Yep. Chant in the new year.
Mm-hmm.
Get up, stand up, and get awake. Yep, you can do it.
I can do it.
Yeah, we can do it.
There's this New Year's kind of prayer. Make this year different by making it all the same.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So is the Mandukya Upanishad all about the dream and...
Yeah, a lot.
It really goes into...
It goes into all of that. It dismisses the whole reality of the creation.
You got the recordings on your website, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Although it's way behind.
It's way behind.
Is it gonna? It's gonna get.
I hope so.
Jackie's gonna do it.
Yeah, I asked Jackie to see if she would meet with me. I hope she can meet with me before I go back to the. You know, I'm gonna go back to the farm.
Are you still working on that, Michael? The Mandukya?
Yes, we're on the fourth chapter, pretty near the end, right? Oh, no,
we've
got a number of verses to go.
One third of the way through. We have
2/3. Oh, 1/3 of the final chapter.
It's a Sunday night class, right?
Yes.
How long have you been working on that? A
couple years.
Yeah,
ever since Sadarshana. Remember that?
Yeah, I was Sadarshana.
Yeah, that's saying from... Ramana Maharshi.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, I like to review those, too.
I know, that is a good one.
Oh, God, yeah, I'm just...
I like Mandukya better, though. Not everyone does.
I love it.
I love it. Just, the end is a little bit
like
intellectually...
The cause-effect thing just drives me.
I know, it is a little...
But
tedious,
I like the actual, like, what is it, 12 verses?
The first three...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the 12 verses plus the first three chapters of the Karika. Karika is not the...
I saw when I was in India, they were doing the Mandukya.
Oh.
And so I had, like, I worked it out afterwards. Like, I had, like, 56 hours on cause-effect while I was there. And I got it, kind of. Like, I was like, okay, yeah. And then now I'm like looking back to my notes and I'm like, what was it? Where was it? I don't remember.
It was all in the dream. That was the whole point.
One time, this was in the 70s in Berkeley. I was in college, but I took time off and moved to Berkeley. And I was with a friend and there might have been other people there, but I remember meeting two of us and we got really stoned and we figured out the secret of the universe.
Yeah.
And at one point, I finally wrote it down. And then I went back to look the next day and it said, the rug is brown.
Yeah,
that
was about
it.
What my notes look like too, thank you.
Yeah, because you're trying to capture it.
Perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
Cider?
I have some. Thank you.
So was tonight recorded? Do you know?
Yes, she's got it on her phone.
But it won't be
I have it too.
You do?
Yeah.
On your phone?
Yeah. Yeah, on my phone.
Can we bump phones?
Can we do that?
I don't do that anymore. Can I?
Oh, you mean through the ray? They don't do that. But you can do AirDrop. What kind of phone do you have?
I have an Android, but it doesn't matter. How big is the file, do you think? Just the.
Might do it through Dropbox or something.
Do you want it? Would you?
I just realized what's wrong with Tibby. It's that it's late.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's after the normal time.
It's after,
she gets to take over her.
Her place. She doesn't know. What are we? What are we still doing here?
Mm-hmm. It's annoying people.
You know,
humans.
I think I need to. I don't know my Dropbox is full. I don't know. I guess I need to clean it out. And then it will work.
You have 2 gigabyte size?
Yeah, I think I don't have to like a sign up, but I just keep
them.
What'd you say?
Give me your email, I'll do it. These are pretty big files. They're